All right, I'd like you to take your Bibles this morning and turn to Romans chapter 8. When we do it God's way, He wants us to be the head and not the tail. In the next two messages, we're going to talk more about how and the kingdom will be ours once again.
Welcome to Mission to Israel, a broadcast ministry featuring author, teacher, and evangelist Ted R. Weiland. The focus of this ministry is to open the eyes of our people and give insight into the issues we find ourselves facing in this day and age. Our address is Mission to Israel, Post Office Box 248, Scotts Bluff, Nebraska 69363, or you can reach us via the web at www.missiontoisrael.org. And now, here is Ted Weiland.
Let's take our Bibles this morning, turn to Deuteronomy chapter 32. Deuteronomy chapter 32. This will be immigration, lawful, legal, and illegal, a.k.a. the good, the bad, and the ugly. This will be part two. Deuteronomy 32, and returning to verses 8 and 9, where it says, "When the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when He separated the sons of Adam, He set the bounds, or boundaries, or borders, of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. For Yahweh's portion is His people, Jacob is the lot of His inheritance." Indeed, Jacob is the lot of His inheritance. We shouldn't question that, but as we saw in the last message, Lot probably isn't the best translation there, and so let me share with you again Young's literal translation, where it says, "In the Most High, causing nations to inherit, in His separating the sons of Adam, He setteth up the borders of the peoples by the number of the sons of Israel, for Jehovah's," or Yahweh's, "portion is His people, Jacob is the line of His inheritance." Yahweh determines the national borders of all the nations, according to this passage, according to the number of Israelites at any given time, and thereby Israel is the measuring line, or the criterion, by which the other nations receive their inheritance. In part one, if you'll recall, in addition to Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verses 8 and 9, we looked at several other Old and New Testament passages, one New Testament passage, that reveal, all of which reveal, that borders between nations, and therefore national sovereignty or national autonomy, and in fact national identity, they were borders between nations, between peoples, and so even involved their national identity, is not only important, we could see through those passages, that it's not only important to Yahweh, but they were established by Yahweh. Again, what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. And what God has put asunder or divided, let no man unite or join together. There are certainly other passages that we could use, in fact there's quite a few, to further establish Yahweh's design for territorial integrity, but I don't think they're necessary. If the passages that we've already looked at in the last message at this point haven't convinced you, then it's unlikely that any additional ones will do so either. But just so you know, there are several other passages that deal with nations being separated, segregation between the different peoples. But that said, before moving on to the most crucial and nearly always overlooked, if not purposely ignored, biblical aspect for determining Yahweh's immigration policy, which I actually won't even get now until the next message. But before getting to that, I think it's important that we also first look at some of the passages that delineate the consequences, or at least some of the consequences, that result from violating Yahweh's border and immigration policies. So with that in mind, turn back, if you're still in 32, back to Deuteronomy chapter 28. And I'm confident that most people hearing this message either now or in the future from the CD or on the webpage will recognize that Deuteronomy 28 along with Leviticus 26 as being the principal, Deuteronomy 28 in particular, being the principal chapter that delineates the blessings and the curses for obedience and disobedience to Yahweh's moral law, including his laws regarding border integrity and for regulating immigration, which the immigration aspect we'll get into, Lord willing, in the next message. So let's begin in Deuteronomy 28 with one of the blessings for obedience first. In fact, let's begin with verse 1 where it delineates or explains what this chapter is, at least the first 15, 14 verses are all about. Deuteronomy 28, actually verses 1 and 2 to begin with, it says, "It shall come to pass, if thou shalt hearken diligently," do not overlook the word diligently. He doesn't just say hearken. He says, if thou will hearken diligently. God calls us to never do anything halfway, or even 99% of the way. Now, we're lucky if we ever get to 99%, granted. But he calls us to the optimum. He says, "And it shall come to pass, if thou shalt hearken diligently." He calls us to love him with all our hearts, soul, minds, and strength. He calls us to surrender all of ourselves to him, and he calls us to hearken to him diligently. So again, "And it shall come to pass, if thou shalt hearken diligently unto the voice of Yahweh thy God, to observe and to do all," do not overlook the word all his commandments. All his commandments. Don't forget, we're told in the New Testament that break one of them, and you've broken them all. And so it's not a, I like 7 out of 10. Or, 9 out of 10 ain't too bad. No, he says you're going to hearken diligently to all of them. "And it shall come to pass, if thou shalt hearken diligently unto the voice of Yahweh thy God, to observe and to do all of his commandments, which I command thee this day, that Yahweh thy God will set thee on high above all nations of the earth, and all of these blessings," don't overlook the word all, "you keep them all, and you're blessed with all. And all of these blessings shall come on thee and overtake thee if thou shalt hearken unto the voice of Yahweh thy God." With that in mind, let's look at one of them. Let's jump over now to verse 13. Verse 13, and it says, "And Yahweh shall make thee," amongst all these other things, he's near at the end of the list, in fact, by now. In verse 13, he says, "And Yahweh shall make thee the head and not the tail, and thou shalt be above only. And thou shalt not be beneath if thou hearken unto the commandments of Yahweh thy God, which I command thee this day to observe and to do them." The same is essentially repeated in Deuteronomy 15, 4 through 6. You won't need to turn there. I'll just read it to you. Establishing in this passage, in this earlier passage, what's meant by the word head. He'd make you the head and not the tail. Deuteronomy 15, 4 through 6, where it says, "There shall be no poor among you." In fact, we're so close. If you want to turn there, of course, do. "There shall be no poor among you, for Yahweh shall greatly bless thee in the land which Yahweh thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it." Now, it doesn't delineate all the blessings, only some of them here. But we know he will bless you based on what we find delineated in Deuteronomy chapter 1 through 14. He says "There shall be no poor among you, for Yahweh will greatly bless thee in the land which Yahweh thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it, only if thou hearken unto the voice of Yahweh thy God to observe to do all these commandments which I command thee this day. For Yahweh thy God blesses thee as he promised thee, and thou shalt lend unto many nations, but thou shalt not borrow." And then the last phrase is, "And thou shalt reign over many nations, but they shall not reign over thee." That's what's meant by being the head rather than the tail, being lifted up above as a nation and as a people and individually, in fact, over others, that we reign over them rather than they reign over us. Now, the import of that particular blessing really comes into focus when it's compared to its counterpart curse for disobedience. And with that in mind, let's jump down to verse 15, where he essentially says the opposite of what he said in verses 1 and 2 concerning the blessings. Here he introduces the cursings. Verse 15, "But it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of Yahweh thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes, which I command thee this day, and all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee." You might want to just flip, if yours is like mine, to get to the end of the chapter, you got to flip a page, and you might notice that the curses end in verse 68. So the emphasis is, he says, listen, if the blessings aren't going to get you there, maybe the curses will. So we've got 15 from 68, really 14 from 68. That's 54 verses versus 14 verses. 50, is that right? 54 verses. So 40 more verses on the curses than there are on the blessings. So the emphasis here, really, he hits the curses strong and hard. Now, with those, that promise of the curses in mind, let's look at, again, the counterpart curse for the blessing that we previously read. Verses 43 and 44, where it says, "The stranger," this is the counterpart curse, "the stranger that is within thee shall get up above thee very high, and thou shalt come down very low. He shall lend to thee, and thou shalt not lend to him. He shall be the head, and thou shalt be the tail." Note here, it's interesting, there's something in the curse that's not found in the blessing. Note here, in the curse, the word stranger. In the Old Testament, there are three different principles. There's more than the three, but there are three different principal Hebrew words translated as stranger, alien, or foreigner, depending upon your translation. Here in Deuteronomy 28:43, the English word stranger is translated from the Hebrew word ger, what might be described as the more Israelite-friendly of the three terms, or the three Hebrew words translated stranger in the King James Version, or foreigner in maybe your versions, the more Israelite-friendly term. Consequently, verse 43 could be interpreted to say, disobey me, that is, of course, Yahweh, and even the non-Israelite ger among you will rise up above you. Not just the Zer, or not just the, what's one of the other principal ones? Zer and Ger and, oh, lost it. But not just them, but even the Ger among you will rise up above you, becoming your head or ruler, to the end, not only that you find him amongst you, but that you, or that he's above you, not just amongst you, but above you, but that to the end that you also find yourself, the implication is that you find yourself trodden under the stranger's feet, metaphorically, of course. That's what it means, being above rather than underneath. Underneath, the stranger is underneath his feet. He's the one that's doing the trotting, thereby the trampler rather than the trampled, us being the trampled rather than the quote-unquote tramplers per Matthew 5 and verse 13. And by the way, Matthew 5 and verse 13, the idea that salt has become savorless, good for nothing but to be trampled under the foot of man, that whole concept goes all the way back to the Old Testament. You know, it goes all the way back to Genesis 3:15, that he would bruise the serpent, metaphorical of whatever it is, would bruise Christ's feet, but Christ would destroy him underneath his feet. And so, indeed, it was done. And that's that theme for God's people carries out throughout. And that's what it's talking about in these passages, being the head rather than being the tail, being above rather than being below, being the trampler rather than the trampled. Yahweh, now listen, Yahweh is ever true to his word. Numbers 23 and verse 19, one of many verses that essentially say the same thing, but this one it says, God is not a man that he should lie, neither the son of man that he should repent. Hath he said, and shall he not do it? Or hath he spoken, and shall he not make it good? That's a great passage. By the way, it was, you know who said that? It was Balaam. The good old false prophet Balaam, who God ends up be destroying. But he understood our God, sometimes better than I think we understand our God. He believed in our God, maybe more so than we sometimes do. Well, with Numbers 23:19 applied to Deuteronomy 28:43 and 44, turn now, God is ever true to his word, with the curses involved in Deuteronomy 28:43 in mind, and God's promise that he will be true to his word, turn to Hosea chapter 5. Hosea chapter 5, and as you turn there, bear in mind that the book of Hosea, particularly the first chapter, bear in mind that the book of Hosea is essentially the 10-tribed house of Israel's divorce papers. For her disobedience, what amounted to her adultery against her husband, Yahweh. And Yahweh sends her packing and gives her divorce papers there in Hosea chapter 1. Now, with that in mind, turn to Hosea chapter 5, and let's begin reading with verse 3. Verse 3, he says, I know Ephraim. Who is Ephraim? Ephraim was the head tribe of the 10-tribed house of Israel. He says, I know Ephraim, and Israel is not hid from me. For now, O Ephraim, thou committest whoredom, and Israel is defiled. They will not frame their doings to turn unto their God, for the spirit of whoredoms is in their midst of them, and they have not known Yahweh. And the pride of Israel does testify to his face. Ah, our pride. Israel's pride. And it testifies to God's very face. Therefore shall Israel and Ephraim fall in their iniquity. Judah also shall fall with them. If you recall, most of Judah, the house of Judah, went with the house of Israel into the Assyrian captivity. And later she falls, of course, as well. Verse 6, they shall go with their flocks and with their herds to seek Yahweh, but they shall not find him. He has withdrawn himself from them. Kind of reminds you of Matthew 7:21-23. A lot of people call upon him and call him Lord. He knows them not. He says, I never knew you. Also, before we continue there, jump back to chapter 2, verses 4 through 6, which kind of describes this same thing. Verse 4, and he says, and I will not have mercy upon her children, for they be the children of whoredoms. For their mother has played the harlot, she has conceived them. She that has conceived them has done shamefully, for she said, I will go after my lovers, and give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, mine oil and the drink. Verse 6, therefore, behold, I will hedge up her way, God is speaking, with thorns, and make a wall that she shall not find her paths. Chapter 5, she will not find me, not at this time, not when I'm divorcing her for what she's done. He hedges her way so that she cannot, on her own, find her way back to Yahweh. The only means of breaking down the hedge was through Christ's death, burial, and resurrection, and his making her a virgin so that he could remarry her again. But that's another story, and we've talked about that many other times. So back to Hosea chapter 5, verse 6 and 7. They shall go with their flocks and with their herds to seek Yahweh, and they shall not find him. He heads their way. He has withdrawn himself from them. Verse 7, they have dealt treacherously against Yahweh, for they have begotten strange children. And I ask you, how did it come about that they had begotten strange children, that is, mixed blood children, from Israelite and non-Israelite parents that were forbidden, as depicted in more detail in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, if you'll recall? How had this occurred? Well, we're told how it occurred, at least in part. Verse 10, and it says, "The princes of Judah were like them that remove the bound." The boundary. Same word as what we saw in Deuteronomy 32 and 8 and 9. He says, "The princes of Judah were like them that remove the bound. Therefore, I will pour out my wrath upon them." And I wrote in something here. I want to see if I... must be, I want to go through verse 13. "Ephraim was oppressed and broken in judgment because he willingly walked after the commandments of men." I think we'll stop there. So he says that the princes of Judah were like them that remove the bound, the boundaries. They removed the boundaries. One reason that they had borne strange children was because they had eliminated their national borders that set them apart nationally and distinct and as a distinct and separate nation. They had removed what God had given them, as contrasted with all of the other non-Israelite nations. And for this, Yahweh's wrath was poured out upon them, that they had removed the boundaries, that they had considered their separated status that God had given them to be above all other nations as perhaps a bowl of pottage, not worth protecting and keeping, and they had borne children. Verse 10 again says, "For this he poured out their wrath. The princes of Judah were like them that removed the bound or boundaries, borders. Therefore I will pour out my wrath upon them like water." What kind of wrath? What kind of wrath? Jump over to chapter 7. And look at verses 8 and part of verse 9. "Ephraim," again the head tribe of the house of Israel, "Ephraim, he has mixed himself among the people." He broke the borders are down, the people are just streaming in, nobody's concerned about who's coming in or what the criteria should be, and he's mixed himself with the people. "Ephraim is a cake not turned," verse 9, "strangers," how does God deal with this? "Strangers have devoured his strength, and he knoweth it not." Strangers have devoured his strength. Now, America's starting to wake up that her strength is being devoured, but it's taken a long time for her to realize what's going on to her, occurring to her. She was oblivious. Strangers are coming in and taking away your strength. Precisely what Yahweh promised in Deuteronomy 28, 43, and 44. But here in Hosea, it relates the reason, the specific reason, or at least one of them, the stranger was rising above them and devouring them. The reason being because they had removed their national borders, thereby allowing anyone and everyone to cross over and invade their land with little or no regard to Yahweh's immigration stipulations. And, as a consequence, the strangers in the land, the idea is that they were rising above the native Israelites. Go to the book of Judges, you see it time and time and time again, except when God gives them a deliverer like Gideon or Ehud or one of the others. It was always disobedience, and the Philistines were coming in, and the Canaanites were coming in, and the Hittites were coming in, and they were rising above them, devouring their strength, rising above the native Israelites, which should sound all too familiar. All too familiar. In fact, when strangers unlawfully reside in the land, in other words, we're not merely talking about undocumented illegal aliens. But unlawful aliens or foreigners, documented or otherwise. Because we're talking unlawful. Don't forget, what man often legalizes, documents, if you will, is more often than not still unlawful with Yahweh. The difference between legal and lawful, if you'll recall from the last message. And therefore, when the strangers unlawfully reside in the land, in the land set apart for Israel, the problem actually becomes compounded as depicted in Numbers chapter 33. Turn over to Numbers 33. And I'm hoping if for no other reason, not only because we're told we'll be cursed in the fashion we are in Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26, but I'm wanting to detail this as much as I possibly can that we can understand the consequences. And we're just talking one area of his law that we're disobeying. But you can hopefully see in this what horrendous consequences come from God's intention that we be bordered, and that we hold to those borders and his immigration policies. He didn't keep everybody out, by the way. He had immigration policies which allowed people to come in, which, again, we'll deal with in the next message. Numbers 33, look at this. Compounded problems. Numbers 33, beginning with verse 50. It says, "And Yahweh spake unto Moses in the plains of Moab by Jordan near Jericho, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, When you are passed over Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you, and destroy all their pictures." New American Standard, I think, says figured stones. "And destroy all their molten images, and quite pluck down all of their high places." Get rid of their gods. Get rid of everything that indicates their god, or would point to their gods. Verse 53, "And you shall dispossess the inhabitants of the land." I mean, talk about border control. This is now yours. I gave it to Abraham 430 years earlier. It's yours now to take possession of. Get them out. "And you shall dispossess the inhabitants of the land and dwell therein, for I have given you the land to possess it. And you shall divide the land by lot for an inheritance among your families." So not only national borders, but borders between tribes and borders between individual families. No communism. And to the more you shall give the more inheritance, and to the fewer you shall give less inheritance. Every man's inheritance shall be in the place where his lot falleth. According to the tribes of the fathers you shall inherit." Verse 55. "But if you will not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, or prevent others from coming across, your unlawful immigrants coming across the border, in an unlawful fashion, but if you will not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall come to pass that those which you let remain of them shall be pricks in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and shall vex you in the land wherein you dwell. Moreover," verse 56, "it shall come to pass that I shall do unto you as I thought to do unto them." Isn't that the blessings and the curses? He says, do it this way, do it my way, and I'll bless you. Do it your way, and I will do to the stranger what I intended to do to you. And vice versa. The same is essentially rehearsed, by the way, to the Israelites by Joshua just prior to his death. In Joshua 23, 11 through 13, let me read this to you as well. He says, "Take good heed, therefore, unto yourselves, that you love Yahweh your God." That's where it begins. God doesn't want us just keeping commandments out of rote. He wants us to do it because we love him and we love our fellow man enough to keep the two greatest commandments, their respective statute, their two greatest commandments, their respective commandments, statutes, and judgments. Take good heed to unto yourselves that you love Yahweh your God. Else if ye, speaking of Israel, do in any wise go back and cleave unto the remnant of these, the non-Israelite nations, the Canaanites in this particular instance, even these that remain among you, and shall make marriages with them, or go in unto them, and they to you, know for certainty that Yahweh your God will no more drive out any of these nations from before you, but they shall be snares and traps unto you, and scourges in your side, and thorns in your eyes, until you perish off this good land which Yahweh your God has given to you. How interesting. How interesting that some Jewish authors have been honest enough to admit that today's non-Israelite Jewish people are a modern fulfillment of these two passages. I doubt they had these two passages in mind, but I think you'll agree these are quite the admissions. Moses Hess, for example, on page 77 of his book Rome and Jerusalem, he says, quote, "The Christian nations, you believe, would have perhaps less objection against the restoration of the Jewish state." Now you think, well, Christians are all for that. Well, this was written in 1862, back when they had more sense and realized what was going on, before 1926, is it? So there was a span of 60-some years before the Jewish state came into being here, and Christians weren't for it, it would appear, at this time. So he says, "The Christian nations, you believe, would have perhaps less objection against the restoration of a Jewish state, since they would hope through this to be rid of an alien population which was always a thorn in their side." End of quote. Exactly what both Moses and Joshua wrote in their respective books. Samuel Roth, on page 129 of his book Jews Must Live, wrote, quote, "Every synagogue we Jews build in Christian countries is a finger of scorn we point at our host, a sore finger we stick into their eyes, like the leering of a senile old woman who does all sorts of foul mischief before you and feels safe in the knowledge that you will not lay hands on her or remove her for fear of contamination." End of quote. Quite the admissions. Quite the fulfillment of what Yahweh said would come upon us if we didn't honor his borders and his immigration policies, not to be limited to the Jews, of course. Boy, just take the Muslims and Islam today. The same for them. Aren't they? Haven't they become pricks in our eyes and thorns in our sides? More so even over in Europe. Now, not to be overlooked, another of the curses of disobedience to Yahweh's laws was that the Israelites would lose their national identity and autonomy, their segregated status, at least temporarily, as a consequence of being dispersed and thereby integrated among other nations. Turn over back to Deuteronomy chapter 28. Another curse. And verse 64. I'm already there. I'll just read it to you. Verse 64, it says, "And Yahweh shall scatter thee among all people from one end of the earth even to the other, and there thou shalt serve other gods which neither thou nor thy fathers have known, even wood and stone." In other words, he's gonna scatter them and thereby integrate them. In other words, or consequently, therefore, segregation, that nasty word today, that politically incorrect word, that biblically correct word, segregation was their blessing. Right? This is a curse. So their segregation was their blessing. Don't forget, that's the way Moses looked at it. You remember from our reading in the last passage. The Goshen segregation was likewise a blessing to the Israelites, especially during the 10 plagues, if you will recall. R.J. Rushdoony on page 531 of his book, The Institutes of Biblical Law, wrote this. He said, Israel was reminded, and this occurs many times, we'll probably look at some of these passages next week or in the next message. He says, Israel was reminded of the discrimination and persecution it experienced in Egypt, and was asked, therefore, to beware of placing other men under similar sufferings. He said, don't forget what they did to you. You don't do it to other nations. Okay? That's important. But then he later says, the evil in that experience was not their segregation into Goshen. That was a favor and an advantage. The evil was in the oppression and enslavement in the legal, and I will add, but unlawful, discrimination against them. Very insightful. And it's one of those passages from Rushdoony that the Reformed Presbyterians don't like somebody to quote. Because while he was politically incorrect on this, they have become more and more politically correct, and they would like to avoid these quotations as such. And I'm going to share some more with you here too, Lord willing. Segregation was the blessing which borders were meant to maintain, whereas integration, except for limited, lawful, and usually temporary, was a curse. Egalitarians, non-Christians and Christians alike, would have us believe that integration is a good thing. However, the integration of Israel with other nations was unequivocally a judgment from Yahweh for rejecting him and his law, including and especially his laws concerning borders, segregation, and immigration. Once again, in Hosea chapter 7, the prophet Hosea described the consequence of unbiblical immigration and thereby integration. Hosea 7, 8 and 9. Ephraim, he has mixed himself among the people. Strangers have devoured his strength, and he knoweth it not. Ephraim, representing again the house of Israel, lost their strength. What was their strength? Well, certainly their God. They lost their God. They also lost their sons and daughters, their future strength, their land, their wealth, their means of livelihood. To the unlawful strangers within their borders and with whom they unlawfully mixed. Hosea 7 could have just as easily been written for modern day America. It's occurring all over again. The consequences of breaking God's laws do not change. On page 294 of Institutes, Rushdoony pointed out one of the ramifications. He says, quote, segregation or separation is thus a basic principle of biblical law with respect to religion and morality. Well, let me add, and I think he held to this himself, also as it concerned nations and nationalities. Obviously, we've already seen that from Deuteronomy chapter 32 and on. He goes on, every attempt to destroy this principle, the principle of segregation and separation, every attempt to destroy this principle is an effort to reduce society to its lowest common denominator. End of that quote. That is the goal of the egalitarians. And coming from a man who probably understood better than some, having done years of missionary work among the American Indians. Rushdoony's comments regarding the 1960 civil rights groups are also applicable, pages 60 and 61. He said, speaking of the United States law or constitutional republic's law, has often been used as an ostensible weapon to gain equality. But such attempts represent either self-deception or an attempt to deceive by the group in power. The quote-unquote civil rights revolutionary groups are a case in point. Their goal is not equality, but power. The black background of Negro culture is African and magic, and the purposes of magic are control and power over God, man, nature, and society. End of quote. This power drive that he's talking about is also evident in today's anti-American, La Raza, that is, the word means the race movement, who not only intend that the which is a movement among the Mexican American or Mexicans, period, who not only intend to invade and infiltrate America with their people and are legally, illegally, and unlawfully, but to literally, not only to invade and infiltrate, but to literally take over the southwestern portion of the United States, including the states of Texas, Arizona, California, and New Mexico. What they describe as reconquista, or reconquest. And don't think for a second, if in fact that day ever comes, that they will stop there. They will keep taking more and more and more if they're ever able to get it started. Islam, of course, is another example of what Rushdoony described as a power movement, which has already taken over many parts of Europe and is gaining increasing stronghold here in America. And a power movement, by the way, is just another way of saying what Yahweh declared in Deuteronomy 28, 43, and 44. The stranger that is within you shall get up to thee, get above thee very high, and thou shalt come down very low. He shall be the head, and thou shalt be the tail. Some people, why is Islam over here? Well, pretty simple. You trace it back to its genesis. It's traced all the way back to the First Amendments, First Commandment violating, polytheism enabling, free exercise clause. They're here because we've disobeyed God's law, starting with the very first commandment of the Ten. Not to mention, with America's current border crisis, the terrorist, the gangs, the drugs and disease, and worst of all, the false gods and religions that are also coming across the border as we speak, with those who are not merely illegal aliens, but unlawful strangers. And let's not be fooled, who are coming here to steal what does not belong to them, meaning particularly anything and everything that can be found, that can be had through America's unlawful welfare system and all that goes with it. Consequences, curses for breaking Yahweh's laws. In this instance, his border segregation and immigration laws, and thus the only answer to ultimately fixing today's immigration problem is certainly not going to be found in the ugly, nor in the bad, but only in the good, in Yahweh's perfect law and altogether righteous judgment, Psalms 19, 7 through 11 again. And in something more, something even more foundational than even Yahweh's triune moral law. Something more foundational that's either being missed or intentionally ignored by the vast majority of Christianity, even pronomian Christianity, who are attempting to apply Yahweh's laws to this problem. Stay tuned. Let's stand. Heavenly Father, we come before you, Lord, once again, thanking you, Lord, for your word, for your guidance, for your direction, for providing us, Father, all that we need to live in a righteous fashion, but not only a righteous fashion, but an extremely blessed fashion beyond, Father, our imagination. Open again the hearts of, Father, your remnant to begin with, and through them let them rule once again at some point in history for the sake of our posterity, and, Father, more importantly, for your sake, to your praise and glory, and for the sake of advancing your kingdom. We ask these things, we praise you, Father, for them, in Yeshua the Christ. Amen.